that the nominee wrote in 1985 when he was applying for a job. He was not a kid. He was 35 years old. He was applying for a fairly high-ranking policy job in the Reagan administration, and he wrote at the time that, in his view, abortion was not protected by the Constitution. And today he said that was his view at the time. And he seemed to suggest initially that it was his view because he was a lawyer in the administration. And Senator Specter pressed him on that and said, no, you really weren't a lawyer at this point. When you wrote this, you were applying for a job. And he sort of said, yes, that was my view at the time. But, of course, since then, Roe has been reaffirmed many times, and we're dealing with a very important precedent. Beyond that, he really didn't commit to much except to say that precedent is important. When you parse through all the language, David Savage from the Los Angeles Times, let me see, did you find any more of a commitment than that?
No. He basically said, if I get an abortion case, I'm going to look first at the issue of precedent. And precedent is not an inexorable command, the Supreme Court has said, but you need a special justification for overturning a precedent. So I think that's all he told us.
And Senator Specter, though, as he did in the Roberts hearings, brought up this idea of a super precedent, of a precedent that had in itself been affirmed, in this case, the Casey decision that reaffirmed Roe versus Wade, a decision in which Judge Alito, sitting on the Third Circuit, had voted the other way.
He voted the other way. His view was not upheld by the Supreme Court. It involved notifying what the part of the law that the Supreme Court upheld and that he would have struck, I mean, that the Supreme Court struck down and that he would have upheld was a Pennsylvania statute, a provision in the Pennsylvania statute that required husbands to be notified when their wives were going to have an abortion. And Justice O'Connor wrote, this was an opinion in the Supreme Court by three justices, O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter, and the part that we firmly believe she wrote says that a woman cannot be treated like a child, requiring notification of a husband. Judge Alito focused on the fact that relatively few women get abortions who are married, and that therefore this was not a significant obstacle. Justice O'Connor and the majority of the court focused on the fact that women often have very good reasons for not notifying their husbands. They may have been the subject of abuse. They may be afraid of their husbands. They may not be able to find their husbands that they're separated from, and that it doesn't matter how few the number is. For the individuals, it's an important obstacle.
The issue switched through much of the morning conversation of Senator Specter's question line and then Senator Leahy's question line onto the question of executive power and specifically whether the president was authorized to conduct warrantless wiretaps without specific authorization from Congress. Indeed, in what a lot of the questions suggested was in defiance of the FISA Act, which Congress had passed, 25, 30 years ago in an attempt to restrict such abuses.
And Senator Leahy took the nominee through a fairly brisk series of questions in which he focused, instead of focusing on the wiretap issue, which he eventually got to, he focused on the so-called torture memo that the administration had in effect for several years until it was revealed in a leak to the press. And that memo authorized torture of individuals, authorized American officials to torture individuals, or redefine torture to be anything only that would be analogous to organ failure, and that was in effect for several years, as I said, until it was leaked to the press. It was then withdrawn. So Senator Leahy said, well, so this isn't on the books anymore. So tell me, does the president have the power to do this? And he really didn't get much of an answer except to say that the president is not above the law, but I don't think he got an exact answer to that.
Well, Judge Alito said this was an issue that might come up before either his court on the Third Circuit or certainly the Supreme Court. Well, joining us here in the booth in the Hart Senate office building is Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. Very good of you to join us today.
Thank you very much.
What did you make of Judge Alito's first round of questioning?
Well, I think it's a beginning. I think this is going to go on for a while. I think in some areas there are a lot of things to be clarified. Particularly in his discussion on stare decisis, which involves the acceptance of precedents. And I think we really need to understand how much he regards precedent. I think that's a very important point. And from the questions, you couldn't really tell.
Senator Feinstein, there have been nominees to this committee, Justice Breyer, for example, and I think Justice Ginsburg, who said that in their view, Roe was settled law. In other words, it wasn't going to be disturbed. This nominee, just as John Roberts, neither one is willing to say that. So for anybody who is not willing to say that, are you willing to support them?
Well, that's a problem for me. I said that rather upfront and rather clearly. Roe and virtually every poll that's been done has over 60% of American support. In my state, it's 71%. Last night on Lou Dobbs, I listened to a CNN poll where it said 56% of the people believe he should not be confirmed if he would overthrow Roe. I think more than one generation of American women, generations of American women have come to depend on this law. And it is a very major factor in any confirmation at this point in time. So when I interviewed him privately, and of course it was a private conversation, he indicated his regard for precedent. As Senator Spector pointed out, Roe has been tested 38 times. Its central holding has been upheld. And we're just going to have to find out. I felt he kind of danced around that question a bit on precedent. Certainly his answer was not dispositive one way or another.
And how would you hope to get him to respond to that point?
Well, by trying. That's the only way.
On the other hand, if he answers you the way you want him to answer you, it is almost certain, as Senator Graham pointed out yesterday, that he would immediately lose the support of a lot of Republican members of the Senate. So why should he do that?
Well, it's not up to me to say why he should do it. It is up to this justice to say that he, or future justice, that he is one who will represent the mainstream of America. And I believe this case, Roe, is in the mainstream of American thinking now. It does provide a balanced formula. It allows the state to set laws beyond a certain point. It takes into consideration the health of the mother. So a lot of questions have been ironed out, plus the fact in a number of opinions it has been modified. So it has been tested, it has been modified, its central holdings have been upheld, and it's an important question. I think another equally important question is whether this justice continues the legacy of the Rehnquist Court, which has been to restrict the authority of Congress to legislate in a number of areas. And that is a critical question. And I think the expanding role of the president, as this president has acted, is also an important role. He said no one is above the law, no one is beneath the law. The question is, does that accord to the president as well as anyone else? He said yes, but we'll see.
Do you think that how do you think this nominee is? I realize we're just at the beginning stage, but he comes to this committee with a much longer written record than John Roberts had. So where are you on this nominee, and where are the Democrats on this nominee versus the Roberts nomination at a similar point?
Well, where I am is that I don't make up my mind. I really don't, Nina, until after the hearing. And I try very hard to keep an open mind. My questions don't necessarily reflect my mind. My questions reflect an effort to probe to see. I expect any Bush nominee to be conservative. That isn't a problem for me. I don't want somebody that is on the far right and out of the mainstream.
You were talking earlier about opinion polls, among other things, about Roe versus Wade. Judge Alito said the one thing that the court needs to do is be insulated from public opinion. That's why they're not elected. They're appointed.
Aha. Uh-huh. But this also enters the area of reliance, whether a population has come to rely on a law and whether that law has acceptance. And that's the only value of this. I don't agree with polls, using polls either, but it shows that Roe enjoys considerable American support, a dominant majority of American support. Therefore, people have come to rely on it, and that's a part of stare decisis. So he has to look at that point whether he likes it or not.
But one could have said that, I suppose, about school segregation, it's certainly for an entire region of the country in the 1950s, and yet the Supreme Court in Brown versus the Board reversed a 50-year-old Supreme Court decision.
Well, of course, that's right. That's right, and that's what the Supreme Court has the power to do. So it actually depends on the law, and I think it depends on how people view the law over a substantial period of time and the amount of testing of that law before the court. I mean, here's a case where the law has been tested, where it has been modified.
We've had these hearings are often a rather elaborate dance. With some nominees telling us more about themselves and some nominees telling us less. If you don't get a lot of information from this nominee, does that, in your view, mean a no vote?
Well, I'm not going to answer that. I'll figure that one out at the end of the hearing.
But I'm trying to figure out, though, what...
I mean, you're trying to get an answer, and I'm not prepared to give one.
No, but
at this
I'm trying to. What is the meaning for you of non-answers as opposed to answers you don't like?
It depends on how deep the non-answers go and how prevalent they are. One has to have something on which to base a vote, and if somebody obfuscates, doesn't answer. Kind of hides behind, well, this might come before me. I think it's really appropriate to ask questions. I think we can ask any question. It's really up to him how he wants to answer that question. I mean, he can say, I can't answer this because the case may come before me, but I can tell you this. And I think that's an important part of it.
Senator Feinstein, Senator Specter, the chairman, has been punctual, to say the least,
in these
hearings. He says he's going to resume at 11:20 Eastern Time. We're coming up on that now, so we'll let you go and get back to your seat on the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nina.
Democrat Dianne Feinstein of California, kind enough to join us here in the booth. Nina Totenberg, the next questioner to come up will be Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts. He is expected to focus on some of those ethical issues, or what he sees as ethical issues, that were also brought up in Senator Hatch's questions. This is about the Vanguard case, the investment company, the mutual fund company, which he had his holdings and did not recuse himself. And, well, anyway, there's Senator Specter, there's the gavel, and we're going to resume.
For Judge Alito on confirmation to the Supreme Court of the United States, and we now turn in sequence to Senator Kennedy.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Let's not forget to start the clock.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. There was one interesting omission between the exchange of yourself and Senator Hatch on the whole Vanguard issue in question, and that was the promise and pledge that you gave to this committee when you were up for the circuit court. I have it right here. It said, I do not believe that conflicts of interest relating to my financial interests are likely to arise. I would, however, disqualify myself from any cases involving the Vanguard companies, the brokerage firm of Smith Barney, or the First Federal Savings Loan of Rochester, New York. So you remember that response. That was a pledge and promise to the committee that you would recuse yourself. Did you not?
Yes, it was, Senator. And as I said in answering Senator Hatch's question, if I had it to do over again, I would have handled this case differently. There were some oversights
I'm sure you might have, and we've had a number of different explanations for this. I'd like to ask the clerk if they would take down and show the judge, or if you'd like to be refreshed about the number of times the name Vanguard appears on the brief and the number of times Vanguard appears on the opinion, which I believe you offer. Would you like to ask the, if I could get a clerk, would show those two documents.
those two down.
Senator, I'm familiar with that.
Right.
I don't really
okay.
need to see the document. Senator, the name Vanguard certainly appears on the briefs, and it appeared in the draft opinion that was sent to us by the staff attorney's office. I just didn't focus on the issue of recusal when it came up. And that was an oversight on my part because it didn't give me the opportunity to apply my personal policy of going beyond what the code requires.
So the individuals that responded on the ethical issues that were involved in this case, did they know that you had pledged and promised to this committee that you would recuse yourself?
I believe that they did. I believe that some of them at least addressed that specifically in
their
letters.
Do you know specifically whether they did or not?
I believe they addressed it in their letters, so they must have been aware of it.
They understood that you had promised this committee that you would recuse yourself. Your testimony now is that those that made a comment upon your ethical behavior knew, as a matter of fact, that you had pledged to this committee that you would recuse yourself from the Vanguard cases.
Professor Hazard, I know, addressed that directly in his letter. I think Professor Rotunda addressed it in his letter. So obviously, if the letters addressed the issue, they were aware of what was said on the Senate questionnaire.
And the final answer, we'll move on, is that you saw the name Vanguard on the briefs, and you obviously saw them on the opinion. You're the author of the opinion. But your testimony here now is, even though you saw the names on that, it did not come to mind at that moment that you had made the pledge and promise to this committee that you would recuse yourself.
I did not focus on the issue of recusal, I think because 12 years had gone by and the issue of a Vanguard recusal hadn't come up. And one of the reasons why judges tend to invest in mutual funds is because they generally don't present recusal problems. And pro se cases in particular generally don't present recusal problems. And so no light went off. That's all I can say. I didn't focus on the issue of recusal.
Well, this is important when the lights do go on and when the lights do go off, because the accumulation of value of a Vanguard had increased dramatically during this period of time, had it not?
I had nothing to gain financially by participating.
No, I'm not asking to get on to the questions of gain or loss or whatever. I'm just asking about the pledge to the committee, which you had given, and the fact that the Vanguard was so obvious both in the brief and in the opinion which you wrote, and the fact that during this period of time there had been a sizable increase in the total value of Vanguard. And as all of us know, if you're dealing with a case dealing with IBM, you can't have even a single sharehold in that. The point about all of this is that interested parties that have come before the courts are going to believe not only in reality but in appearance that they're going to get the fair shake. And that you have said was certainly your desire, and I certainly commend you for at least that desire. But in this case, this was the something that we recognize and is extremely important. Judge, in just the past month, the Americans have learned that the president instructed the National Security Agency to spy on them at home. And they've seen an intense public debate over when the FBI can look at their library records. And they've heard the president announce that he's accepted the Cain Amendment barring torture. But then just days later, as he signed it into law, the president decided he still could order torture whenever he believed it was necessary. No check, no balance, no independent oversight. So, Judge, we all want to protect our communities from terrorists, but we don't want our children and grandchildren to live in America that accepts torture and eavesdropping on American citizens as a way of life. We need an independent and vigilant Supreme Court to keep that from happening, to enforce the constitutional boundaries on presidential power and blow the whistle when the president goes too far. Congress passes laws, but this president says that he has the sole power to decide whether or not he has to obey those laws. Is that proper? I don't think so. But we need justices who can examine this issue objectively, independently, and fairly. And that's what our founders intended and what the American people deserve. So, Judge, we must know whether you can be a justice who understands how to strike that proper balance between protecting our liberties and protecting our security, a justice who will check even the President of the United States when he's gone too far. Chief Justice Marshall was that kind of justice when he told President Jefferson that he had exceeded his war-making powers under the Constitution. Justice Jackson was that kind of president when he told President Truman that he could not use the Korean War as an excuse to take over the nation's steel mills. Chief Justice Warren Burger was that kind of justice when he told President Nixon to turn over the White House tapes. And Justice O'Connor was that kind of justice when she told President Bush that a state of war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the rights of the nation's citizens. So I have serious doubts that you'd be that kind of justice. Your record shows time and again that you have been overly deferential to executive power, whether exercised by the president, the attorney general, or law enforcement officials. And your record shows that even over the strong objections of other federal judges, you bend over backwards to find even the most aggressive exercise of executive power reasonable. But perhaps most disturbing is the almost total disregard in your record for the impact of these abuses of powers on the rights and liberties of individual citizens. And so, Judge Alito, we need to know whether the average citizen can get a fair shake from you when the government is a party, and whether you will stand up to a president, any president ignores the Constitution and uses arguments of national security to expand executive power at the expense of individual liberty, whether you will ever be able to conclude that the president has gone too far. Now, in 1985, in your job application to the Justice Department, you wrote, "I believe very strongly in the supremacy of the elected branches of government." Those are your words. Am I right?
They are, and that's a very inapt phrase.
Excuse me?
It's an inapt phrase, and I certainly didn't mean that literally at the time, and I wouldn't say that today. The branches of government are equal. They have different responsibilities, but they are all equal, and no branch is supreme to the other branches.
So you've changed your mind?
No, I haven't changed my mind, Senator, but the phrasing there is very misleading and incorrect. I think what I was getting at is the fact that our Constitution gives the judiciary a particular role, and there are instances in which it can override the judgments that are made by Congress and by the executive. But for the most part, our Constitution leaves it to the elected branches of government to make the policy decisions for our country.
All right. I want to move on. Mr. Chairman, the clock is off. There are a number of points I want to cover and be timely, so I'm leave it up the chair. But
Senator Kennedy, we have you're correct. We have a timer
All
over
right.
here. We're trying to get the time fixed.
All right. Well, if I would know when I have 10 minutes left.
Let us see if we can't get that clock within the view of Senator Kennedy.
Digital clocks in the well here of the Senate Hart hearing room are not working at the moment, so that's what they're talking about.
There you go.
Oh.
Be quiet over there. Scurrilous dogs. Judge. Quite frankly, your record shows you still believe in the supremacy of the executive branch, Judge Alito. I believe there is a larger pattern in your writings and speeches and cases that show an excessive, almost single-minded deference to the executive power without showing a balanced consideration of the individual rights of people. So let's discuss some of your opinions. These cases deal specifically with one form or another of executive power, the power of authorities intrude in homes, search people who are not even suspected of committing a crime. The Mellett versus Hemer, where the U.S. Marshal Service forcibly evicted a family of dairy farmers from their home and their farm. These farmers had no criminal record and were suspected of no crime. But after they fell on very hard times, property was sold at a public auction. U.S. Marshals were sent to evict them. Remember, the marshals were sent to carry out a civil action, not a criminal action, a civil action. These farmers had committed no crime. Now, I respect the U.S. Marshals. They have a tough job, and they do it with great professionalism. But in this case, the marshals entered the house with loaded guns. The family was unarmed, did not resist, but still the marshals pointed loaded guns at their heads, chests, and back. One marshal chambered a cartridge in his gun. Twice they pushed the wife into her chair. The trial judge held there was enough evidence in this case to have a jury review the facts, hear the testimony, and decide whether the marshals used too much force to evict these farmers. But that didn't sit well with you, Judge Alito. You grabbed the case away from the jury. You wouldn't let them hear the testimony or make up their own mind about whether the marshals had gone too far. No, you simply substituted your judgment for the jury's and decided that the marshals' conduct was, as a matter of law, objectively reasonable. Judgment for the marshals, no jury of their peers for the farmers. Why, Judge Alito? Your colleagues on the Third Circuit, Judge Rendell, called the marshals' conduct Gestapo-like. Gestapo-like. She said that seven marshals detained, terrorized a family and friends, ransacked a home while carrying out an unresisted civil eviction. The trial judge thought the decision should be made by the jury. Why didn't you let the jury exercise an independent check on the marshals' actions?
There was some additional information regarding these people that was important, and that was that they had threatened other people, as I recall, and there was evidence about the possession of weapons and evidence that they would be dangerous, and that was the basis on which the marshals acted the way they did. This was a case in which the marshals were sued for civil damages, and they asserted what's called the qualified immunity defense, and that means that if a reasonable person could have thought there was a basis for doing what they did, then they are entitled not to be tried. And that's the law. I didn't make up that law.
That's right.
Let him finish, Senator Kennedy.
That's not a legal standard that I made up, and that was the way I saw the case, and that's the way the other judge who was in the majority saw the case. Now, these cases involve difficult line-drawing arguments at times, and I respect Judge Rendell's view of this very much, but reasonable people will view these things differently.
Well, the issue then was the actions of the marshals, whether it was reasonable. And here you have a judge, Judge Rendell, saying it was Gestapo-like to talk about terrorizing a family and friends, ransacking a home while carrying out an unresisted civil eviction. Aren't juries there to make a judgment and determination whether it was reasonable or not reasonable? And didn't, by your action, take that away because you ruled as a matter of law that their conduct was reasonable?
The Supreme Court has told us how we have to handle this issue, and it is for the judiciary to decide in the first place whether a reasonable officer could have thought that what the officer was doing was consistent with the Fourth Amendment. We have to make that decision. Now, if we decide that there's an issue of fact, if there's a dispute in the testimony about the evidence that the marshals had or about what these individuals were doing at the time when the search is taking place or what the marshals did, then certainly those factual issues have to be resolved by the jury.
Well, that's the view of Judge Rendell. Let me move on, if I could, to the Doe v. Grudy. And I know that you have, Senator Leahy has talked about this and gone over the factual situation about the strip searching of a 10-year-old girl. In this case, they police got the warrant to search the house. They found the suspect outside, marched him inside where they encountered wife and 10-year-old. The police took the wife and daughter upstairs, told them to remove their clothing, physically search them, not as a protective frisk or search for weapons, but in the hopes of finding contraband. And that is when Judge Chertoff, the former chief federal prosecutor for New Jersey, the former head of the criminal division in the Justice Department, President Bush's current Secretary of Homeland Security, held that the police went too far. As Judge Chertoff said, a search warrant for a premise does not constitute a license to search everyone inside. You differed. You differed. And you've reviewed with us your reasoning for it, the fact that you felt that the affidavit, which had been filed by the police, should be included in the search warrant. Judge Chertoff takes strong exceptions to that, as does the Fourth Amendment, as does the Fourth Amendment. As you mentioned yourself, the affidavit represents the police, the police's view about the situation, but the affidavit, the search warrant, is what is approved. What is approved for by the judge. Those are two different items that come up every time in many, many instances. Why did you feel that under these circumstances, that affidavit should be included, the result of which we have the strip searching of a 10-year-old, 10-year-old that'll bear the scars of that kind of activity probably for the rest of her life? Fourth Amendment is clear. We want to protect the innocents. We want to have a search warrant that is precise so that the police understand it and the person that is being served to understand it. That was all spelled out in the judges. But you went further than that. You said, well, in this case, we're going to include the affidavit. And as a result of your judgment in this case and the inclusion of the affidavit, we have the kind of conduct against this 10-year-old, which he will never forget. Why? Why, Judge?
Senator, I wasn't happy that a 10-year-old was searched. Now, there wasn't any claim in this case that the search was carried out in any sort of an abusive fashion. It was carried out by a female officer, and that wasn't the issue in the case. And I don't think that there should be a Fourth Amendment rule, but of course it's not up to me to decide that minors can never be searched, because if we had a rule like that, then where would drug dealers hide their drugs? That would lead to greater abuse of minors. But the technical issue in the case was really not whether a warrant can incorporate a search warrant, an affidavit. There's no dispute that a judge or a magistrate issuing a warrant can say that the affidavit is incorporated. And that was done here. The issue was whether, and it was a very technical issue, was it incorporated only on the issue of probable cause, or was it also incorporated on the issue of who would be searched? If the magistrate had said in the warrant, this warrant is incorporated as to the people who may be searched, and then in the affidavit it said, and it did say this very clearly, we want authorization to search anybody who's on the premises, then there'd be no problem whatsoever.
Well,
The warrant said it was incorporated on the issue of probable cause, and I thought that reading it in a common sense fashion, which is what we're supposed to do, that necessarily meant that the magistrate said there was probable cause to search anybody who's found on the premises, and that's what I'm authorizing you to do.
And that is what Judge Chertoff took strong exception in a very eloquent statement in talking about the protections and the reasons for the strict interpretation for the warrant. Let me move on. Judge Alito, your Third Circuit decisions don't exist in a vacuum. I'd like to, Mr. Chairman, at this point, since there's been some questions about whether we're fly-specking these cases, I'd like to include in the appropriate place in the record the Knight Ritter studies that concluded that Judge Alito never found a government search unconstitutional. The Yale Law School professors, the rule for government is almost every case reviewed. This was their conclusion. the Washington Post stories with regards to the cases, and also Professor Cass Sunstein's conclusions that the studies that Judge Alito rules against individuals in 84% of the time.
In accordance with our practices, if you want them in the record, they will be there without objection.
Okay. So just looking at your writings and speeches, Judge Alito, you've endorsed the supremacy of the elected branch of government. You've clarified that today. You argue that the Attorney General should have the absolute immunity even for actions that he knows to be unlawful or unconstitutional, suggested that the court should give a president signing statement great deference in determining the meaning and the intent of the law, and argued as a matter of your own political and judicial philosophy for an almost all-powerful presidency. Time and again, even in routine matters involving average Americans, you give enormous, almost total deference to the exercise of governmental power. So I want to ask you about some of the possible abuses of the executive power and infringement on individual rights that we're facing in the country today. Judge Alito, just a few weeks ago, by a vote of 90-9, the Senate passed a resolution sponsored by Senator John McCain to ban the torture, whether it be here at home or abroad. As a former POW in Vietnam, John McCain knows a thing or two about torture. For a long time, the White House threatened a veto of the legislation, and finally, Senator McCain met with the president and convinced him to approve the anti-torture law. 2 weeks after that, the president issued a signing statement, no publicity, no press release, no photo op, where he quietly gutted his commitment to enforce the law banning torture. The president stated, in essence, that whatever the law of the land might be, whatever Congress might have written, the executive branch has the right to authorize torture without fear of judicial review. Now, I raise this issue with you, Judge. I raise this with you because you were among the early advocates of the so-called presidential signing statements when you were a Justice Department official. You urged President Reagan to use the signing statements to limit the scope of laws passed by Congress, even though Article 1 of the Constitution vests all legislative powers in the Congress. You urged the president to adopt what you described as a novel proposal to issue statements aimed at undermining the court's use of legislative history as a guide to the meaning of the law. You wrote these words: the president's understanding of the bill should be just as important as that of Congress. With respect to the statement issued by the President Bush reserving his right to order torture, is that what you had in mind when you said, wrote, the president's understanding of the bill should be just as important as that of Congress?
When I interpret statutes, and that's something that I do with some frequency on the Court of Appeals, where I start and often where I end is with the text of the statute. And if you do that, I think you eliminate a lot of problems involving legislative history and also with signing statements. So I think that's the first point that I would make. Now, I don't say I'm never going to look at legislative history, and the role of signing statements in the interpretation of statutes is, I think, a territory that's been unexplored by the Supreme Court, and it certainly is not something that I have dealt with as a judge. This memo was a memo that resulted from a working group meeting that I attended. The Attorney General had already decided that as a matter of policy, the administration, the Reagan administration, would issue signing statements for interpretive purposes and had made an arrangement with the West Publishing Company to have those published. And my task from this meeting was to summarize where the working group was going and where it had been. And I said at the beginning of the meeting that this was a rough first effort to outline what the administration was planning to do. And I was a lawyer for the administration at the time. And then I had a big section of that memo saying, and these are the theoretical problems, and there's some of them are the ones that you mentioned. And that's where I left it. And all of that would need to be explored to go any further.
Well, just, Judge Alito, in that the same signing statement undermining the McCain anti-torture law, the president referred to his authority to supervise the unitary executive branch. That's an unfamiliar term to most Americans, but the Wall Street Journal describes it as the foundation of the Bush administration's assertion of power to determine the fate of enemy prisoners, jailing U.S. citizens as enemy combatants without charging them. President Bush has referred to this doctrine at least 110 times, while Ronald Reagan and first President Bush combined used the term only 7 times. President Clinton never used it. Judge Alito, the Wall Street Journal reports that officials of the Bush administration are concerned that current judges are not buying into its unitary executive theory, so they're appointing new judges more sympathetic to their executive power claims. We need to know whether you're one of those judges. In the year 2000, in a speech soon after the election, you referred to the unitary executive theory as the gospel and affirmed your belief in it. So, Judge Alito, the president is saying he can ignore the ban on torture passed by Congress, that the courts cannot review his conduct. In light of your lengthy record on the issues of executive power, deferring to the conduct of law enforcement officials even when they're engaged in conduct that your judicial colleagues condemn, Judge Chertoff, Judge Rendell, subscribing to the theory of unitary executive, which gives the president complete power over the independent agencies that protect our health and safety, believing that the true independent special prosecutors who investigate executive wrongdoing are unconstitutional, referring to the supremacy of the elected branches over the judicial branch and arguing that the court should give equal weight to a president's view about the meaning of the laws Congress has passed, why should we believe that you'll act as an independent check on the president when he claims the power to ignore the laws passed by Congress?
Well, Senator, let me explain what I understand the idea of the unitary executive to be. And I think it's there's been some misunderstanding, at least as to what I understand this concept to mean. I think it's important to draw a distinction between two very different ideas. One is the scope of executive power. And often presidents or occasionally presidents have asserted inherent executive powers, not set out in the Constitution. And we might think of that as, how big is this table, the extent of executive power. And the second question is, when you have a power that is within the prerogative of the executive, who controls the executive? And so you might, and those are separate questions. And the issue of, to my mind, the concept of the unitary executive doesn't have to do with the scope of executive power. It has to do with who within the executive branch controls the exercise of executive power. And the theory is the Constitution says the executive power is conferred on the president. Now, the power that I was addressing in that speech was the power to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, not some inherent power, but a power that is explicitly set out in the Constitution.
Would that have any effect or impact on independent agencies?
Well, the status of independent agencies, I think, is now settled in the case law. This was addressed in Humphrey's Executor way back in 1935 when the Supreme Court said that the structure of the Federal Trade Commission didn't violate the separation of powers, and then it was revisited and reaffirmed in Wiener versus the United States in 1958.
So your understanding of any unitary presidency that they do not therefore have any kind of additional kind of control over the independent agencies than has been agreed to by the Congress and signed into law at the current time?
I think that Humphrey's Executor is a well-settled precedent. What the unitary executive, I think, means now, we would look to Morrison, I think, for the best expression of it, and it is that things cannot be arranged in such a way that interfere with the president's exercise of his power on a functional, taking a functional approach.
Just, I want to just mention this signing of the executive understanding of the legislation that we passed banning torture, what the president signed on to. The executive branch shall construe the Title 10 and Division A relating to detainees in a matter with the constitutional authority of the president to supervise the unitary executive branch as the commander-in-chief and consisted with the constitutional limitations on judicial power. Therefore, it's the warning that the courts are not going to be able to override the judgments and decisions. That's certainly my understanding of those words, which will assist in achieving the shared objective of the Congress and the President. That statement there, in terms of what was agreed to by Congress, 90-0, by John McCain, by President Bush, and then we have this signing document, which effectively just undermines all of that, is something that we have to ask ourselves, whether this is the way that we understand the way that laws are to be made. It was very clear in the Constitution who makes the laws. When the executive, the Congress and the Senate makes it. The President signs it, and that's the law. That's the law. These signing statements and recognizing the Steinman safes and giving these value in order to basically undermine that whole process is a matter of enormous concern. Thank you.
Judge Alito, Senator Kennedy had noted that there were substantial gains, as he put it, in the Vanguard stock or the Vanguard asset during the period of time that you held them, but he did not give you an opportunity to answer that. I don't like to interrupt in the midst of a series of questions, but you can respond to that if you care to do so at this time.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had additional holdings in Vanguard during my period of service, but I think the important point as far as that is concerned is that nobody has claimed that I had anything to gain financially from participating in this case, and I certainly did not.
Senator Grassley?
Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa.
I have a more positive view of you than has just been expressed. I can't be cynical about your judging. In fact, maybe from what I have criticized the Supreme Court in a long period of time, I might feel you're too cautious, too willing to follow precedent. But I think in regard to Vanguard, the point ought to be made that you did nothing wrong. You didn't violate any law or any ethics rule. And the point's being made that maybe you didn't remember a promise you had made to this committee. But let me assure you, don't lose any sleep over that. If senators kept every word they made to their constituents, there wouldn't be any senators left. And so there's always a shortness of memory, and with not ill intent, whether it's on the part of a senator or whether it's on the part of Judge Alito. I hope the viewing public is impressed by your intellect and your legal capabilities and your judicial record. Clearly, they're seeing that you have the kind of background and practical experience that it takes to be a Supreme Court justice. In addition, I think you've demonstrated now, after five or six of us asking your questions, that you're very candid in answering questions so far, and being honest with our committee. These nominations hearings that we're holding are, of course, a unique opportunity for all of us, senators and the public, to explore more in depth how Supreme Court nominees view the roles of justice, how nominee approaches constitutional interpretation and precedent, as well as a nominee appreciation of the separate branches of government, and you've been involved in all of those discussions already this morning. It's unfortunate that some extreme liberal groups have attacked your commitment to the law as well as your honesty and integrity, but now you are doing your best and I think doing a good job of setting the record straight. So before I ask you some questions, I want to bring up some of these issues that have been brought up against you, and you don't necessarily have to respond in any way. I just think it's points that ought to be made as I see you, and I'm only one senator, but I think I've had a good opportunity to study you and particularly your cases. I'd like to address these ethics charges that we've seen generated by some of the left-wing liberal interest groups and even my colleagues on the other side of the aisle. These allegations are just plain absurd. And you're going to see some charts that hopefully will be held up that I'm not going to point to, but bring up some of these charges, because I think that we want to prove that these allegations are absurd. It's puzzling to me that anyone would actually believe these claims, especially when people who know Judge Alito the best, people who've known him for a long period of time and who've worked closely with him, better than any of our senators would know you.
And there's a chart being held up behind Senator Grassley that is titled, Judge Samuel Alito, Man of Integrity.
The fact is that the ABA looks at issues such as integrity and ethics when it evaluates a judicial nominee, and it found you, Judge Alito, to be unanimously well qualified, a rating that Democrats have always claimed to be a gold standard. The ABA didn't find a problem with Judge Alito's record. Moreover, several leading ethicists from across the political spectrum review these allegations, and they all agreed that you, Judge Alito, acted properly and that none of these charges have merit. It says in a letter from George Mason University President Law Professor Ronald Rotunda, already referred to by members and in a letter to Chairman Specter, quote, neither federal statute nor federal rules nor model code of judicial conduct of the American Bar Association provide that a judge should disqualify himself in any case involving a mutual fund company, and they give as examples Vanguard, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, simply because the judge owns mutual funds that the company manages and holds in trust for a judge, end of quote. So basically, according to law, Judge Alito was not required to recuse himself in the Vanguard case, but he did it anyway. So let me repeat. Five leading ethicists all say Judge Alito did nothing wrong. Professor Thomas Morgan, quote, in my opinion, Judge Alito's participation in a Vanguard case was in no way improper, nor does it give any reason to doubt that he would fully comply with his ethical responsibilities if confirmed. And Professors Stephen Lube and David McGowan wrote, you do not need to be a fan of Alito's jurisprudence to recognize that he is a man of integrity. Other judges and justices would do well to follow this example, end of quote. In addition, no complaint filed against Judge Alito has ever been validated. And to top it off, we've heard glowing statement after glowing statement from folks closest to the judge, your law clerks, Republicans, Democrats alike, as well as lawyers.